So, last time I discussed, starting with an algebraic variety as a, thought of as a complex submanifold of complex projective space, thinking of divisors on this algebraic variety. So there were specific ones which came from a choice of homogeneous coordinates on the complex projective space. But that was an instance of a more general phenomenon of a codimension one submanifold, or what's called in algebraic geometry subvariety, something which is locally defined by a single equation. On X, and trying to recover mappings into projective space by studying collections of divisors which form what are known as linear systems. So the linear system containing the divisor D, or generated by the divisor D, consisted of all the divisors D prime, which could be written as a combination of divisors that are known as irreducible divisors, those which are locally defined by a single equation, with integer coefficients. I think I neglected the condition that the coefficient should be non-negative when I wrote it down last time, such that the difference, d prime minus d, is the divisor of a meromorphic function. In other words, the set of zeros minus the set of poles of a meromorphic function. Or if you studied that set of meromorphic functions themselves, you would look at the meromorphic functions whose poles were at worst along d. So that was the link between a kind of extrinsic point of view where X was embedded in projective space to begin with, and a more intrinsic point of view where you were able to recover the embedding into projective space by studying these codimension one submanifolds or subvarieties of the original algebraic variety. And then there was a particular linear system which we looked at, which is the so-called canonical linear system. And this consisted of things which looked like the divisor of a meromorphic form, except, well, yeah, so I should be a little more concrete about this. The notation gets, people use the notation a little bit sloppily. So they'll write a canonical divisor to be the divisor of a meromorphic form alpha. So here, f was a meromorphic function, but up here, alpha is a meromorphic n form, where n is the dimension of the variety x. And then the linear system kx would really represent the set of divisors of alpha such that alpha is a holomorphic n form, so no poles allowed. And that's just going according to my convention that I needed positive linear combinations of divisors to be representing things that are in the linear system. So the linear system would be empty, technically, if there aren't any holomorphic n forms. And it means that in this case of the canonical bundle being trivial, this means that this is unique. It just consists of a single, well, it just consists of the empty divisor. I guess I want to write that as the sum of zero. Well, the divisor, which is zero, right? So the definition of Kx being zero means that there exists a holomorphic n form which is nowhere zero, and that's when that's translated into this language of linear systems means that the only thing in the linear system is the zero, the divisor of that holomorphic n form, which is itself zero or empty. So I wanted to talk about, before doing the example, I wanted to go back and mention one kind of motivating analogy, which I forgot to say last time, which is that if we wanted to study the set of all Riemann surfaces of a fixed genus, well, there are several things that you can look at. You can look at, on the one hand, conformal classes of metrics. So So metrics up to conformal equivalence. Each such conformal class has a unique representative with constant curvature. So we can single out specific metric representatives of the conformal classes by solving the equation that the derivative of the curvature is zero. This is the analog of starting with all possible Kähler metrics, say, and singling out the Ricci-Flatt Kähler metrics in the Calabi-Yau case that I was discussing. Or another equivalence with the set of all conformal classes of metrics is the set of all complex structures or holomorphic structures. And that's like translating the objects that we're studying into the study of algebraic geometry. So trying to put things into complex projective space and study them in terms of the equations which hold in complex projective space. So that's an analogy to the process that we're trying to mimic in higher dimension. But I do want to go back to Riemann surfaces to give some examples of this theory of divisors, where it hopefully will become fairly concrete. So let me let X be a Riemann surface of genus G. I'll take G to be at least 2. It'll be endowed with a complex structure. So I'm thinking of it as a complex manifold of complex dimension 1. And there always exist holomorphic one-forms on X. In fact, there are G of them. There's a G-dimensional space of these things. So I'll let alpha 1 to alpha G be a basis of the space of holomorphic one-forms. And what that means is that each alpha J in local coordinates looks like some function fj of z dz locally. You can't write it that way globally, but you can write it that way locally, where z is a local coordinate. Now, the set of zeros of one of these things, divisor of alpha j, that's some collection of points. So I'll call that njk pk, something like this. So the divisors on a Riemann surface are codimension 1, so they're just points. And if I write it as a linear combination like this, I get points. And these NJK PKs form, if we manage to embed the thing, so if we use the canonical system to map X to projective space, and if that happens to be an embedding, and I'll discuss in a moment the conditions under which that holds, then such a divisor represents the intersection of X with a specific line. So this would be ZJ equals 0. And these would be the points P1, P2, P3. And this would be a case where the divisor of alpha J was exactly P1 plus P2 plus P3. Well, that's misleading because it's never even degree for the canonical series. Let me put in another one. Plus P4. If that line or hyperplane section, in general, what I have here is a codimension 1 linear space, so this is a linear subspace of codimension 1, which is why it's going to meet this one-dimensional submanifold in a finite collection of points. But if that linear subspace had been tangent, then the integer that occurs here would have measured the order of tangency. So if it's a simple tangency, you would get an integer 2. If it was a multiple tangency, you could get integers 3 or higher. And that structure is all reflected in the structure of the set of possible divisors, which are here geometrically represented by intersections with codimension 1 linear subspaces in the space. So the specific divisors that we're looking at are these canonical divisors, and we're looking at this canonical map. And there's a special class of Riemann surfaces that I want to consider, we'll let X be a so-called hyperelliptic curve. It's a special kind of Riemann surface. These are things which have a local defining equation, which looks like y squared equals a polynomial in x, and to get the genus to come out to be g, I take a polynomial of degree 2g plus 2, so that means x to the 2g plus 2 plus lower order terms. A0 x to the 0, a 2g plus 2 x to the 0. I regard the solutions of this inside of C2, and then I have to take the closure of that, so that's contained inside of X bar sitting inside of P2. But when I take the closure of that, I introduce a rather bad singularity, and one of the nice things about birational geometry is that there's this blowing up operation, which I described in some form yesterday, where you can replace under some circumstances points by lines, and if I apply that to the point at infinity for this curve, I end up with a curve X, which is contained in something called the one-point blow-up of P2, which is a space that maps down to P2. So I don't want to discuss this in too much detail right now, how I achieve the X. I just want to worry about this particular equation. Now, it turns out, so why are hyperelliptic curves relevant? Well, it's an easy family of curves to write down. In fact, one of the nice things about hyperelliptic curves is that there exist hyperelliptic curves of every genus. So if you wondered whether or not there was a complex structure on a Riemann surface of arbitrary genus, this would answer the question immediately. Working out that the topology is determined from the equation by exactly the genus being the G in it. Well, half the degree minus one, as I've described it up there, is an easy little exercise. And this shows you right away that there are Riemann surfaces of genus G for each G. On the other hand, if you study the canonical linear system and the mapping defined by the canonical linear system, this is always 2 to 1 for a hyperelliptic curve. In other words, every holomorphic one-form on X is, in fact, the pullback of a necessarily meromorphic one-form on P1. So I should have mentioned that I can, when I do this compactification, there's a natural map from the blow-up of P2 at P down to P1, and this P1 contains the C1, which is the span of X, whose coordinate is X. So if I just use the X, there's an obvious 2-to-1 projection from this hyperelliptic curve. Given the value of X, there are two Y values, and that 2-to-1 projection is actually replicated by this canonical map. It always factors through that 2-to-1 mapping down to P1. And another way of saying that is that the holomorphic one-forms on X are always the pullback of meromorphic one-forms on P1. Why does meromorphic turn into holomorphic? Well, there are these branch points at the 2g plus 2 zeros of that polynomial. And if you make a local computation for such a so-called branch point, you discover that a pole located at that branch point goes away and becomes just an ordinary point on the holomorphic form upstairs. So this produces both a class of examples which shows us that Riemann surfaces, in the sense of complex manifolds, exist for arbitrary genus. It also shows us that the canonical linear system for a Riemann surface is not always an embedding, but there's a very pretty theorem, classical theorem, which says that if X is not hyperelliptic, then phi kx is an embedding. That's the first statement. Second statement says if x is hyperelliptic, and the genus is at least 3, then phi 2kx is an embedding. So if we're willing to study 2kx instead of kx, we can find embeddings uniformly for all Riemann surfaces, hyperelliptic or not, if the genus is at least 3. And for genus 2, you have to go to 3k. So if g equals 2, by 3kx is embedded. So this illustrates the phenomenon that I mentioned last time, that although a given linear system might not define an embedding, the key property is whether multiples of that linear system define an embedding or not. And here we can see that the property which the canonical series uniformly has for genus at greater than or equal to 2, which is my working assumption here, is that the sum multiple, in fact, the third power, or the third multiple of the canonical linear system, actually defines an embedding into some projective space. Well, in fact, the map is always a map to projective space of dimension g minus 1. That goes along with the fact that I mentioned that g, in addition to its interpretation in terms of the topology, also has an interpretation as the dimension of the space of holomorphic one-forms on this Riemann surface. So there's always a map from x to p g minus 1. And you see right away what happens when genus, in the case of genus 2, this is a map to p1. It cannot be an embedding. Just because the only Riemann surface inside P1 is P1 itself, and that has genus 0. And this is, in fact, 2 to 1. Well, the degree, So the degree of a subvariety of projective space is the number of points of intersection with a complementary linear subspace. So in this case of Riemann surfaces that I'm looking at, the complementary linear subspaces are codimension 1, and I just have to count the number of points of intersection. In other words, count the number of zeros of a holomorphic one-form. And the degree is always 2g minus 2. So in this case of genus 2, the degree of the divisors is 2. And in fact, the way that comes about is you take the linear subspace, which is now a point, a P0 sitting in there. You look at the quote-unquote intersection, which really means the inverse image under this map of that P0. That's going to be 2 points above it. That's the meaning of degree 2, and therefore we see that it's a 2-to-1 map. So the conclusion, if you accept my earlier characterization of hyperelliptic curves, sorry, I don't need to invoke a big theorem. The conclusion is that it's hyperelliptic. You can see just in local coordinates that it will have to be of the form y squared equals some polynomial in x, where x is a local coordinate on x1, and you can work out that it has to take the form that I mentioned earlier. So that's the case of genus 2. If I take genus 3 and assume it's non-hyperelliptic, well, this time x is going to map to p2. The degree is 2g minus 2, which is 4. So I just get some subvariety of p2 of degree 4. P2 has homogeneous coordinates z0, z1, z2. So I'm allowed to write down an arbitrary degree 4 polynomial so long as it defines a non-singular subvariety. So, for example, I might include these three terms, z0 to the 4th, z1 to the 4th, z2 to the 4th, and then I would have other terms of homogeneous degree 4 equals 0. I could put coefficients here, lambda and mu, and coefficients on the other terms as well. There are lots of terms in such a polynomial, and those coefficients are going to specify the complex structure. So as I vary the coefficients, I'll vary the complex structure, and I can describe the totality of all genus 3 curves by writing down all possible equations of degree 4. This is the picture right here for the degree 4 genus 3 non-hyperelliptic curve in P2. It's got lines in P2, meaning it in 4 points each, and any line defines one of these canonical divisors, and that exactly picks out the sets of 4 points which lie on lines within this projective embedding. Now, if you actually wanted to describe all of the genus 3 Riemann surfaces in this way, what you would have to do is take the set of all degree 4 equations, which can be labeled by their coefficients, but then you would want to mod out by the equivalence between equations, which comes from the action of PGL3C on this set of equations. And also multiplying an equation by multiplying all the coefficients by a common scalar does not affect the set of zeros, which is what we're looking at. So this C star is for multiplying the equations by a common zero. This is the natural action of the symmetry group of CP2 on the equations of a fixed degree, and that will just permute the various Riemann surfaces. To make sense of this quotient, you'll actually have to remove some subset here to make a decent quotient. And even after removing a subset, the quotient isn't an ordinary orbit space quotient, but it's a quotient in algebraic geometry known as the geometric invariant theory quotient, which means that I take the set of, well, I identify two orbits if one lies in the closure of the other. And with those little caveats where I had to leave out some equations that were so horribly singular that I can't really include them in my problem, and then mod out by the appropriate group action in some slightly generalized sense, I can describe the entire set of Riemann surfaces of genus 3 exactly in terms of this projective embedding. This is minus, well, let me just say let me just take the non-hyperelliptic ones and say that the non-hyperelliptic ones are contained in there. By allowing arbitrary degree 4 equations, I've allowed singularities. Singular limits naturally arise in algebraic geometry almost every time you make a natural construction in algebraic geometry, and one has to do some further analysis to figure out what happens with those singular limits. And then the hyperelliptic curves behave a little bit strangely for this particular problem, so you have to treat that separately or else perhaps go to 2K. The reason I stuck with K here is because it's pretty concrete to put it inside of CP2. Just continuing up the list of possible G's, if I go to G equal 4, in the case of G equal 4, X maps to P3. The degree is 6, and it turns out that there is always a degree 2 hypersurface which contains the image. And X can be, in fact, written as the intersection of this degree 2 hypersurface, Q, with a degree 3 hypersurface, C. Now, that's a reasonable thing, because if I now take the intersection with a degree 1 hypersurface, a linear subspace, H, then H intersect Q intersect C will have just the product of the degrees as the number of points of intersection, which is 6. So that sort of matches with the degree that we already knew to be 6. And what that means is that if you choose coordinates, well, if I take Z0 up to Z2 as being homogeneous coordinates, then I can write a pair of equations plus more terms, and then a cubic equation, and I'll certainly need coefficients this time. So I'll describe this genus 4 Riemann surface. as a so-called complete intersection, an intersection of two hypersurfaces inside of a three-dimensional space. I mentioned at the end of last time that this adjunction formula could be used to figure out what was going on when you had intersections like this. So starting from the canonical bundle of P3, which I asserted to you was the same thing as minus 4 times the hyperplane here, so you can find a meromorphic 3 form on CP3 whose pole is exactly 4 times this H, for any specific hyperplane H. The canonical divisor of the degree 2 hypersurface Q would then be minus 4H plus Q restricted to Q. And in terms of linear equivalence, Q is the same as 2 H's. It has the same linear equivalence property as 2 H's because it's degree 2. That becomes minus 4H plus 2H restricted to Q. And then the canonical divisor of X itself would be KQ plus C, since it's the intersection with C, restricted to X, which is Q intersects C. KQ, we just worked out, was minus 2H. C gives me a plus 3H. That's restricted to X. So I get H restricted to X. And that's exactly what I've been studying. I've been studying a Riemann surface X, which is canonically embedded, whose mapping to P3 is actually given by its canonical bundle. And this H is the kind of extrinsic way of describing the linear system which was mapping into P3. So this all worked out nicely for a complete intersection like this. When you get to genus 5, you get a similar picture of a complete intersection. You get an intersection of three quadrics, three degree 2 hypersurfaces, excuse me. Each of these is degree 2, Q1, Q2, and Q3. Similar calculation would be minus 5H plus 2H for the first equation, 2H for the second equation, 2H for the third equation is equal to H. That's essentially what happened in that multiple restriction calculation I had a moment ago. So again, I got canonically embedded Riemann surface by expressing it as a complete intersection. But once the genus is at least 6, I no longer have such a simple way to describe all the Riemann surfaces. So genus greater than or equal to 6 implies that the canonical image is not a complete intersection, is not the intersection of precisely G minus 2 hypersurfaces in PG minus 1, which is what you might have hoped for, given that it's something of dimension 1 sitting inside of something of dimension G minus 1. So the codimension is G minus 2, but unfortunately, we can't describe it in such a simple way. To pursue this line of investigation requires setting up a lot of machinery in algebraic geometry. Instead of just looking at the equations, one should look at the defining ideal of X, which will be the set of all homogeneous equations. Set of all FD of Z, such that FD is identically 0 along X. So if you remember the notion of ideal from algebra, that's supposed to be something which is closed under addition and also closed under multiplication by arbitrary functions. If you multiply by an arbitrary homogeneous polynomial and the first polynomial vanished along X, then it times anything else will still continue to vanish all along X. And these defining ideals have the property that they're finitely generated. And the relations among the ideals, so in another algebraic context familiar to physicists, the set of relations, which are like ghosts in another context, that's also finitely generated. The syzygies, which are relations among relations. Syzygies. These are relations among relations. Or in another physics context, ghosts for ghosts. That's also finitely generated, etc. This is a general phenomenon. If you need to go back, you can find finite generation as far back as you need to. And in fact, you can describe the entire ideal not only with a set of finitely generated steps, but, I mean a sequence of finitely generated steps, but that sequence is also finite. So there's a finite length set of generators, relations, syzygies for syzygies, and so on, going back only a finite number of steps, which completely describes the ideal. Moreover, there are bounds on the sizes which depend only on the basic algebra geometric properties of X. And in particular, in the case I'm discussing now of Riemann surfaces, those bounds depend only on the genus. So you can imagine the generalization of the thing, which unfortunately I erased right on that board, where I had originally just described things in terms of a single equation, and all I had to do was look at the set of degree 4 equations minus a certain singular set and then mod out by some PGL. That has a vast generalization in which I look at all possible ideals generated by a certain number of elements with relations given by a certain number of elements in certain degrees, and syzygies given by certain numbers in certain degrees, and so on. Take all of those ideals. Again, I should probably subtract off some bad subset, and then I mod out by the action of whatever the automorphism group is, the PGL of the projective space, and I produce a structure which accurately describes all of the algebraic varieties in question. Although the complexity, obviously, is immense if the defining ideal is complicated. But this is the basic strategy for describing the set of varieties with given invariants. And just because it's a term which shows up from time to time, it's probably worth knowing that this general construction of finding the set of all subvarieties of projective space with certain specific invariants specified is known as a Hilbert scheme. And the Hilbert schemes are described in, well, roughly this way. I'm telling you some white lies about this story, but it's described in roughly this way. So I should say that the applications of this machinery that we have in algebraic geometry for constructing moduli spaces in the sense of algebraic geometry, which is pretty powerful machine, the applications to physics to date have actually used only the tip of the iceberg of that machine. It's not a very easy machine to apply in full generality, as you can imagine from this rough description that I've given. And it's been applied essentially in cases that boil down to complete intersections of this sort. So here the machine is much more concrete. I can write things in terms of equations. I don't have to worry about relations among equations. The equivalence relation, which is given by the PGL action, is pretty easy to implement. And I just have a bunch of coefficients that have a group action on them, and I'm taking the quotient by that group action, essentially, to describe the moduli space. Those are the cases in the generalized context of things like toric varieties as opposed to projective spaces. Those are the cases where this machine has been applied in studying string backgrounds. But I wanted to mention that there's this big generalization which is potentially available. There are a number of phenomena which might be missed by restricting your attention to only these simpler cases. And so although we've learned some interesting things by those limited applications, there are some it's possible that we've been misled, that if we try to generalize from lessons learned, that we'll draw some wrong conclusions because we haven't really invoked the full complexity of the structure. Okay, so that was a set of examples about Riemann surfaces. Now, I want to go through a parallel analysis for the reason I didn't spend so much time on Calabi-Yau manifolds of dimension 1 is that they're not so interesting. So X of genus 1, I mean, they're plenty interesting, but they're not going to show the complexities in algebraic geometry. In the case of Riemann surfaces, genus 1 corresponded to Kx being 0, having degree 0, in fact. That's a case which has a very familiar moduli story. There's one complex parameter, the J invariant, and it distinguishes among the possible elliptic curves, with some subtleties having to do with special J values where extra automorphisms come into play. If we go to dimension 2, well, following the terminology that I was using yesterday, I don't, strictly speaking, get a Calabi-Yau manifold at either dimension 1 or dimension 2. Dimension 1, I would just call it a torus. Dimension 2, it's hyperkähler, and I was drawing a slight distinction between hyperkähler and Calabi-Yau. So I can look at hyperkähler surfaces, non-flat hyperkähler surfaces, and this leads to the theory of what's known as K3 surfaces. So I'm now going to let Y, I'll change letters so as not to get confused with this X, be a K3 surface. The first remark is that no matter how, well, if I put Y into projective space somehow, and there are K3 surfaces, let me let Y be a K3 surface with a chosen complex structure. But no metric chosen. Just to make it clear what context I'm in. So if I just look at the complex structures on K3 surfaces, there are some which cannot be embedded into complex projective space. I mentioned yesterday that all of the metrics could be described, or at least the generic metrics could be described, by means of embeddings into complex projective space. And the resolution of the apparent discrepancy between those two statements is that there's an entire S2 full of compatible complex structures for a given metric. So if I were working with metrics, I would have some freedom to choose the complex structure. If I'm choosing the complex structure in advance, then I can't make quite such strong statements. So let me assume that I've embedded, that I'm able to embed Y into complex projective space in some fashion, and I want to consider the hyperplane sections. So I've been calling these H intersect Y, or what this means is the linear equivalence class given by intersections with the set of zeros of a homogeneous coordinate. And I'm going to call that X because that's a Riemann surface. So the adjunction formula, which I showed you last time, gives us a way of calculating the canonical divisor of X. Canonical divisor of X is the canonical divisor of Y plus this hyperplane that we're intersecting with, restricted to X. Canonical bundle of Y is 0, so that's H restricted to X. And what this tells me is that if I embed a K3 surface Y into complex projective space and consider a divisor on it, which is the intersection with the hyperplane, I find a canonically embedded Riemann surface. So this entire theory of canonical embeddings of Riemann surfaces has a big influence on the structure of K3 surfaces. Yeah. There's another little ambiguity in language, which is just a fault of my upbringing. I mean, whenever I say K3 surface, I really ought to say complex curve. I never ought to say Riemann surface. And if I say Riemann surface, I ought to say K3 four manifold. But K3 four manifold sounds too bizarre. Can't make myself say it. So the so-called K3 surfaces are complex surfaces, but real four manifolds. So in the case of genus 2, I had X mapping to P1 with a 2-to-1 map. That must mean that a corresponding phenomenon happens for Y. So in fact, there's a notion of a hyperelliptic K3 surface. Hyperelliptic K3 surface would be a K3 surface equipped with a map to projective space, which is 2-to-1 onto its image. And that corresponds to cases where the hyperplane section of that map is the image of a complex curve which is hyperelliptic under its canonical map. So that has to be happening here, and in fact you can see that another way. I should have mentioned that n is g, right? We took the hyperplane class. Hyperplane itself is isomorphic to Pn minus 1, and because we're canonically embedding now, that needs to be Pg minus 1. Well, I'm suppressing one detail, which is that a K3 surface has a property known as regular, which guarantees that the dimensions of this space of linear systems will be the same on the hyperplane class and on the full space. Okay, so I've got Y mapping to Pg, which in the case of G equals 2 is P2. That's surface mapping to surface, so it couldn't have been an embedding in this case. And in fact, it's 2 to 1, just as before. And all we have to do to describe the equation now is generalize from y squared equals f of x to y squared equals f of x1, x2, again of degree g, of degree 2g plus 2, which is 4, which is 6. And take the solutions of that sitting inside of C3 and take some kind of closure inside of some appropriate space to describe the actual K3 surfaces. So there's this notion of genus 2 K3 surface, hyperelliptic genus 2 K3 surfaces. And you can actually use the construction, some variant of this construction, to show that hyperelliptic K3 surfaces exist for arbitrary genus. Yeah, I guess I should have pointed out after I mentioned this business about not being complete intersections and how hard it is to describe the moduli, how that seemingly simple remark that there exist hyperelliptic curves of genus G for arbitrary G is actually very powerful. If you were just doing the analysis in this kind of abstract sense, and we're not aware of that example, it would actually be difficult to establish that this is a non-empty space. We can define Hilbert schemes all over the place with specific numerical invariants, and most of the numerical invariants that we write down for the Hilbert scheme gives you a gives you an empty space. Lots and lots of possible collections of invariants for algebraic varieties simply are never realized. So the fact that we have a construction, a simple-minded construction with hyperelliptics to produce these families is a very useful thing. And similarly here, we're finding K3 surfaces of genus G for arbitrary G just by this special construction that's available in the case of hyperelliptics. Yeah, I'm taking a K3 with a specific algebraic embedding or specific map to projective space, and the dimension of that space is G. So it actually depends on a K3 plus a choice of linear system. It's not an intrinsic property of the K3. So that was genus 2. Genus 3, non-hyperelliptic. Well, again, Y is going to map this time to P3 with the P2s that lie in there corresponding to these X's, which were degree 4 curves. So Y will have to be a degree 4 surface. But this time in 3 homogeneous variables. So for example, z0 to the 4th plus z1 to the 4th plus z2 to the 4th plus z3 to the 4th is equal to 0. But as before, you can allow arbitrary coefficients for degree 4 surfaces and get a very large family of surfaces. It turns out that these depend on 19 complex parameters when you count. Genus 4, well, again, Y will have the same kind of description as X does. It will be described by a degree 2 hypersurface intersected with a degree 3 hypersurface, except now Y is embedded in P4 instead of in P3. So it's the intersection of degree 2 and a degree 3. And again, if you count all the coefficients and mod out by the action of PgO4, you end up finding 19 complex parameters. Genus 5, X in, y in P5 now, is the intersection of three degree two hypersurfaces. And when you count the coefficients that are available and you mod out by PGL6, you discover that there are 19 complex parameters. Well, GLE6 implies not a complete intersection, just as the case of curves. In fact, if this were a complete intersection, when you took a hyperplane section, you'd get a complete intersection. So it's more difficult to describe the moduli space. You have to invoke this more general machine. But it turns out that, for fixed G, there are 19 complex parameters describing this family. Pardon?
Is it easy to show it's not empty?
I showed you it's not empty because of these hyperelliptics. It's not so easy. You have to be a little bit careful because you have to go from H to 2H, essentially, just pull that trick to put them together into a common family. But that gives an explicit construction of K3s with a primitive class of genus G. So I have this interesting situation where if I looked at the familiar space MG, which is the moduli space of complex curves of genus G, this has complex dimension3G plus 3. So the space of all Riemann surfaces of fixed genus is growing with G. On the other hand, the set of K3 surfaces, so I don't know what to call it, maybe by analogy I'll call it NG, which is the set of all, well, it's really Y together with a linear system, D, K3 surface with a linear system of genus G, this has complex dimension 19 for all G. That implies right away that if G is and if you look at pairs, the set of pairs consisting of an X contained in a Y, so a Riemann surface, a complex curve of genus G contained on a K3 surface, that has dimension, well, for each of the K3 surfaces, I get to choose one of the hyperplanes. So there's a G parameter family of choices. That has dimension 19 plus G. This is minus. So when G is bigger than 11, not every complex curve of genus G lies on a K3. In fact, oddly enough, for genus 11, the generic curve does lie on a K3. For genus 10, it's also true that the generic curve does not lie on a K3. But for genus 9 and below, it does lie on a K3. Very strange state of affairs. Well, we know a lot about K3 surfaces. That's partly because the condition to be hyperkähler is quite a bit stronger than the condition to be Calabi-Yau. And that's reflected in a lot of aspects of the geometry. These NGs for various G all fit into a common parameter space, which I'll call N, which is moduli space of complex structures on K3. And this has complex dimension 20. It's a rather unpleasant space in many ways. It's much better to do it the way that we've now been taught by physicists to do it, which is to include the metrics So if I include metrics as well as complex structures, and then if I forget about the complex structure completely, which I've told you a few times, there's an S2 full of complex structures for each metric. This space, n bar, is a much nicer space to deal with. That's a space which is locally modeled on O319 mod O3 cross O19. But there's some minus Z there. However, there is some moduli space of complex structures on K3s. It has complex dimension 20, and it contains all of these as codimension 1 subvarieties, all these 19-dimensional spaces as codimension 1 subvarieties someplace in there. And that's the story of the structure of these hyperkähler manifolds in complex dimension 2. But although it was closely tied through this adjunction formula to the story of Riemann surfaces, in fact, the structure of Riemann surfaces becomes more and more misleading the larger the genus gets. It's only by virtue of some apparent miracle there that you actually get to continue to have some complex curves which actually lie on K3 surfaces as the genus gets larger and larger. So it's a rather delicate matter making sure that that there are some curves which actually lie on K3 surfaces. Well, my reason for going through that story was in part that I'd like to sketch one approach to attempting to classify Calabi-Yau manifolds in higher dimension, which is that you might try to follow the same strategy of looking at a Calabi-Yau manifold together with an embedding into projective space, and then studying the projective properties of the hyperplane section. So, just to make things concrete, let me discuss Calabi-Yau threefolds for a minute. We know tens of thousands, greater than or equal to, tens of thousands of kinds of Calabi-Yau threefolds. They're virtually all of complete intersection type, but maybe in a complicated ambient space, which nevertheless we have some way of controlling. So they're the analogs in this picture that I've been sketching of genus less than or equal to 5. So the big question, or one of the big questions is, how many are there? How many types are there? And in particular, it's still an interesting open question as to whether the number of types is finite or infinite. The kind of delicacy of this story of curves on K3s suggests that this is likely to be a quite subtle question, particularly as the genus gets larger and larger. With K3 surfaces, although you might have thought since the genus is getting larger and larger, it becomes, as you can see, harder and harder to get the curve to lay on the K3 surface, and you might have worried, if you didn't know already that there were K3 surfaces of every genus, you might have worried that it wouldn't be possible to make this work out. I should point out that the reason it becomes more complex, again, comes back to this, the structure of these ideals. If I have to describe the ideal in terms of not only generators but relations and syzygies and going further on back, then when I take a family of curves, or family of varieties, which I'm hoping will all be hyperplane sections of a variety of larger dimension, if they're all hyperplane sections of a common variety, the structure of their ideals have to be very closely tied together because they can be inferred from the ideal of the larger variety. And if that set of ideals is kind of generically deployed within the set of possible polynomials, it won't be possible to fit things together into hyperplane sections of a variety of larger dimension. So that's the basic technical reason that you suspect that most varieties that you put into projective space will not actually be hyperplane sections of a variety of larger dimension. Well, as I mentioned, a possible strategy for addressing this question Well, I want to suggest that we have no idea whether there are finitely many or infinitely many. That I can give you plausibility arguments for both sides, and I guess I'm about to say that in more detail, but I don't know. I really don't know. I very firmly don't know whether they're finitely many or infinitely many. Pardon? So G, it was the analog of G being less than or equal to 5. So that was when I had X of genus G and Y being a K3, right? Because in the case of G less than or equal to 5, that was a case where I got complete intersections in complex projective space. So what I'm saying is that people have systematically written down complete intersections in toric varieties. Those are cases where you can study the structure just by using generators of the corresponding ideal. You don't ever need relations. Actually, there have been a few extensions of this to other related cases, such as determinantal varieties. Determinantal varieties are nice things where you have a lot of control over the first couple of elements in that presentation of the ideal. And again, it's not surprising that you can lift something from one projective space to being a hyperplane section in another projective space. But if you wanted to study the question in general, you would have to be studying things that were more the analog of Riemann surfaces of high genus, where the ideal is very complicated, and you would not expect, unless something special geometric is happening, you would not expect to find a given Riemann surface to be a hyperplane section of another one. Well, I'm very tempted to give you a digression, another digression about Riemann surfaces in K3s, but I don't think I have time, so I won't. So let me just mention this possible strategy, and maybe I'll come back to my other digression shortly. So I'm taking now Y to be a Calabi-Yau threefold. I'm considering an X contained within Y, which is a surface. I'm going to study the mapping from Y to projective space defined by the linear system. Actually, it might not initially even be well defined. And I'm going to assume that phi sub x is an embedding. Well, exactly the same computation that I made a minute ago in the case of K3 surfaces using the adjunction formula tells me that X is canonically embedded. So what you might do is ask, what is the structure of algebraic surfaces whose, well, I'll ask a slightly weaker question. This implies that Kx, what I just told you was that Kx was very ample, but that implies that Kx is ample. And that implies, in fact, that the dimension of the set of meromorphic functions with a pole at worst along nkx grows like n cubed asymptotically as n gets large with a positive coefficient. That's a much weaker consequence of this. Now, a surface with this property is called general type. And there are lots and lots of surfaces of this properties with this property. And you might ask, can I give a rough classification of these surfaces that's analogous to the classification of complex curves by their genus? And the answer is that there's a little chart, a little graph that you can make that relates two specific invariants of surfaces. And on the one hand, I can count the number of intersection points of two representatives of this linear system Kx. So I take Kx and I take another hyperplane section in the embedding and I count the number of intersection points. On the other hand, I can look at the Euler characteristic, just the topological Euler number of x. So I can treat those as basic invariants. And there are some lines in this graph. Everything, the only invariants which occur lie in between here. There's some dotted line with the property that over here things are dense and over here things are sparse. Relatively sparse. X, that's K prime. That's the second representative of the canonical divisor of KX. It's C1 squared. I never said C1, so I was trying to give it in terms of that I've used in my lecture. So there's some chart that you can make like this. There are lattice points here which you can look at. There's some slight numerical restriction which says essentially the sum of the coefficients have to be divisible, an integer divisible by 12. But aside from that, you have the possibility of a finite number of families of complex surfaces of general type for each of those lattice points. And the number of occupied sites, well, let's see, it's dense. If you look at the rational slope lines, then the set of rational slope lines which have an occupied site on them are dense, and the ones which are occupied tend to be occupied all the way out with some density. Anyway, people have made sort of qualitative studies of the set of all these surfaces, but there's some sort of plot, and of course the ideals are getting more and more complicated as you move out on this thing, just as the ideals got more and more complicated as the genus increased in the previous case. Very little knowledge at all of which parts consist inside a Calabi-Yau. So you can then try to look at the set of existing Calabi-Yaus, but it's, even though it's tens of thousands of things, it's still going to just be some finite collection of points on this graph, so I can't really learn too much about it. If the set of Calabi-Yaus is infinite, then probably it's infinite. Oh, but I should mention that the complete intersection stuff is all down here, roughly. So we've only explored a very small corner of the graph. Any complete intersection surface of general type sort of lies toward the bottom of this graph. So the parts up here, where there are lots of interesting other surfaces which don't have obvious ways to put them on threefolds, that's completely unexplored territory. So you might be tempted to conclude that there's so much unexplored territory that there's bound to be an infinite number of Calabi-Yau manifolds on this basis. On the other hand, it's really hard to become a hyperplane section of a Calabi-Yau manifold because all of your neighbors have to have a similar ideal to yours. Not all of them, but a lot of your neighbors have to have a similar ideal to yours, and that's a difficult property to guarantee. That's the number of holomorphic two forms. Number of holomorphic two forms on the surface. Is that what you're saying? Yeah. If I assume that the surface is regular, then yes. I mean, there's an invariant, which is chi of O, which is 1 minus H10 plus H20. And I'm kind of assuming implicitly that H10 is 0 if I'm going to match up dimensions between hyperplane sections, linear system restricted hyperplane sections, and the original one. And this, on the other hand, is C1 squared plus C2 divided by 12. So it's direct. That's why there's a divisibility by 12, and you can directly see how many 2-0 forms you get. Okay, well, I'm sort of out of time, so I think I'll stop there.
You guys sign up for a picnic over by the door on the table.
Pardon? Discussion session at 3:30?
3:30.
Well,
let's thank Dave again for those two lectures.